Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The day today is April 22nd, 2023, and this is episode 375. I'm the ghost Mark Ames in Rochester, New York, and I'm on the line with John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. the Warnerd, in a hotel in the southeast little pocket of the Italian peninsula. John, how you doing?
I'm okay. Yeah. I'm in Bari. Because we had to leave one of the weirder hotels we've ever been in for a relatively normal one. And I mean, I was telling Catherine, I think I should just write a book about weird hotels I have known and where our latest one would rank. Because as I mentioned last time, I think we ended up for a week in a freeway side hotel in the middle of nowhere. It's just a giant 8-story hotel by the side of the freeway. You open your window and it sounds like you're in LA. And there's nothing else around. And I was starting to wonder, why does this place exist? You can hardly walk away from it. You know, it's all for cars. It's as hard to get out of on foot as an airport. And it also has a weird sort of tidal effect. Like most of the time it's nearly empty and then suddenly it will fill up. Like we had to come into town because we thought after scheduling tonight's show, we'd stay there for another day, and it was impossible because a couple of buses all blacked out, looking like they had third-stage guild navigators in them, showed up out of nowhere, and the hotel suddenly filled up, and there's no room at the inn for us. Mm. And we were trying to argue, where does this fit in the scale of weird hotels? Like there was the afternoon brothel place in Naples with the ancient Egyptian theme. And then there was the Love Hotel in Tirana in Albania.
Mm, yes.
Where we didn't know in advance that we'd booked a place that would have a neon sign at the head of the bed saying, love. Love with a heart, a neon heart. Also,
sexy.
it was the very definition of sexy.
Is that near the Erdogan pizza place or
no? That was in Durres. Erdogan pizza was more of a gritty working class thing, and Durres was a very gritty town. Tirana, by contrast, got a lot of Gulf money. Well,
yes.
We'll be talking about Gulf money in the show today, one place Gulf money went was Tirana.
I heard great things about Tirana. I mean, I was there well over 20 years ago, and it was pretty alien, and I was used to kind of traveling to alien places. It was pretty alien and important. Hadn't had its little post-communist boom yet, but not long after that, from everything I've heard, it really did. I've heard great things about Tirana.
It's definitely a boom town.
Yeah.
I don't know. We got kicked out of a bus in the middle of town and lost a Kindle in the process, so I wasn't too thrilled about it. But you just drive into town on the bus, and it just looks like money, especially for us because we'd come from Macedonia. There's no money in Macedonia. But Albania has had a lot of money, and it's a glossy skyline.
Mm-hmm. Briefly, before we get to our interview, we have a great interview with Joshua Kreis to talk about the latest events in Sudan and also sort of give us a deeper, broader context. And it's really fascinating.
It's an amazing interview.
Amazing, yeah. But before that, I just want to point out, you just put out a great Radio Warnerd subscriber newsletter, Orame Ardanad versus Male and Marxism-Leninism. And for people who haven't subscribed yet, if you happen to be listening to this, you know, subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. This is a great newsletter here. You want to just give a brief background?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's very hard to get information on the wars in Ethiopia over the past half century, and they strike me as one of the most amazing stories around. But I thought I would try to find novels about the wars of the Ethiopian Derg, meaning committee, meaning the Marxist-Leninist dictatorship of Ethiopia, in the 1980s against the Eritrean insurgency. And I found one called Oromai, which had been translated into English, and tried to write a newsletter about it. And partly because I was having a lot of health problems, partly because of the obscurity of the topic, it took me a long time to write. But the novel itself is amazing. For starters, it cost the author's life. I mean, like the disappearance of the author, you know, that's something you heard about in English class in grad school.
Right.
But this author actually disappeared, as in he published this novel, they let him publish it at the time, and then, as often happens with dictatorships, they decided they really didn't like it that much, and they didn't like the author that much. And therefore, his car was found by the road outside Addis Ababa, and his body has never been found. Yeah. It was about Operation Red Star, a massive, very Bolshevik-style military and political and cultural offensive to transform Eritrean society, you know, with artillery and self-criticism meetings and God knows what else. And it was a massive failure. And the author, who had an Indian father and an Amhara mother, wrote an honest account of this, of being part of the junta that makes the big trip to Asmara, capital of Ethiopia, of Eritrea, rather, from Addis Ababa, because Mengistu, the leader, wanted every one of his whole group there. They all go there. They listen to four-hour speeches by Mengistu, and then the army fails, and the whole thing comes apart. And he tries to be loyal, the author, but he ends up having to say some things about Mengistu that Mengistu didn't like.
Yeah. You know, he was torn between not getting killed by Mengistu, but making the novel interesting enough, right?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand,
literally died for his art.
Yeah, he did. I don't think he expected to die for his art, but it must have crossed his mind at the same time. Like,
yeah, the lines that may or may not be crossed now, those lines may be different a year from now or 2 years from now. I mean, but what I love about this newsletter is the way that Marx, you know, you'd have to have been somewhat alive from this era, the way the sort of pedantic spats with very serious consequences over, you know, over basically grad school terminology, Marxist-Leninist grad school terminology, and it gets instrumentalized by people who don't really give a shit about Marxism-Leninism that much, but the people who do care pretty much all die.
They all die.
Yeah. And it's just, it's grim. It's, you know, it's grim. It's, you can't help but being comical in the way that every dark fate of everything.
Yeah, it's
is
comical. Some, it's ridiculous. Yeah. It's heroic. It's bloodthirsty. It's all that stuff at once.
But great story. Right. So let's get to, you know, a current story, this the war in Sudan. And our interview with Joshua Kreis.
We're very happy to have with us today Joshua Kreis, a writer who's been working on Sudan since 2011 and who's written for New Left Review, Small Arms Survey, and The Baffler. In fact, it was when Mark and I saw his article in New Left Review called Gunshots in Khartoum, that we were really impressed and asked Joshua if he could come on the show to talk to us about what's going on in Sudan today.
Yeah, so First of all, thanks for coming on the show, Joshua. Really appreciate it. So all our listeners.
Pleasure. Long time listener, first time caller. I've always wanted to say that. Now I get to say that. So there we go.
You got it. All right.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, it's exciting. We did a show. I mean, I have seen that you specialize, I mean, your research more South Sudan, right? And I know John has written about South Sudan. I think we did a episode early on in early Radio Warner days on South Sudan and talked about it a decent amount. But that's your specialty more, right? Or is it all of Sudan?
Yeah, I mean, I did my PhD on Abyei, which is a contested territory between Sudan and South Sudan. And I spent much of the last 10 years doing conflict work looking at South Sudan. But I've also been working more recently in Sudan with the Rift Valley Institute and with Small Arms Survey. So I was last there in September in Khartoum. And then
you were in Khartoum just last September?
Yeah, and I was there the year before that in the week running up to the coup. And I left the day before the coup, just like the U.S. envoy.
Was that those famous Easter vacations you wrote about? Supposedly the whole diplomatic corps was absent.
I think it was this time, right?
Or is
That was this time, yeah.
Tell us a little bit before we go into this about your impressions of Khartoum. So you've been in Khartoum primarily post Bashir era, or were you there even before
then?
Yes,
post Bashir era.
Tell us what it's like, some basic impressions. I mean, I doubt very many of our listeners, we have an international audience, but I doubt very many of them have been there.
I mean, Khartoum's a fantastic city. It has some of the same qualities of Cairo that you can spend all night sitting around drinking tea and discussing. Even under Bashir, it was not a dictatorship that like a listenership might imagine, which is incredibly restrictive and totalitarian and controls all the activities. There were these popular committees that ran sort of neighborhood by neighborhood, which tried to monitor for loose women and also determine kickbacks and corruption. But there's an amazing, just like lively art scene, lively discussion scene. And that was really evident last September, that even though we've been like a year into a coup by that point, I was going to art events done by the resistance committees, these groups that were instrumental, were largely the force that overthrew Bashir. Massive amounts of discussion. Like it was a weak coup and a weak dictatorship. What was sort of apparent by September was that it was as scruffy and as broken down as I've ever seen Khartoum, right? Huh. It's a big urban city.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's had a lot of investment in the sort of the second half, as it were, of Bashir's regime from the Gulf. And so a lot of Gulf money flowed in and really transformed parts of the city. Then parts of absolute slums and totally like centers of informal work. But it's sort of astonishing, really, to see reports now from what Khartoum is and how quickly it's become this. So one of the centers of the conflict is in Khartoum Idnane, Khartoum 2, which is a site which is, along with Amarat, the place where all the internationals live. A lot of the NGOs are based. And they have a coffee shop called Ozone. Ozone has sort of water spray, which is sent out over the terraces by fans. And there's sort of the diplomats live in this space, which is entirely sequestered, really, from the rest of the city. So a coffee there costs 8 times as much as it does just on the other side of the street.
Wow.
Has the best waffles in the world, apparently. This is not true, but that's the claim. and there was this fictional life in these coffee shops that diplomats had about how the transition was going, what Burhan and Hemeti were doing. And outside of those coffee shops, the city really, over the last year, has been careening from disaster to disaster as inflation grows, the economy's broken down. Like, really, Hemeti came out as this agreement was signed in December. So Hemeti is one of the main two commanders currently struggling for Sudan, and said the coup was a mistake. And in some senses, the coup was a mistake, even understood like by the coup's own, like by the people who organized the coup, because they couldn't manage to in any way protect this economy.
Right.
So it was sort of a glorious city on the banks of the Nile, still with the imprint of the British, full of clubs, So there's the Railway Workers Club, there's the National Security Officers Club. There are all these sort of like remnants of British colonialism. There's overlaid a sort of 21st century Gulf modernism. And all of that was just crumbling under the coup.
Mm.
One of the events that I don't pretend to understand here, and there are many, is why the Sudanese elite, what you call, I think, the riparian elite, the people who live along the Nile, allowed South Sudan to leave in 2011, because that took a gigantic chunk out of the GDP, right? Because South Sudan has the oil, and that money used to go to Khartoum, and now it doesn't. So can you give us a little background on why that happened, what happened in 2011, why they let South Sudan go?
Yeah, absolutely. So you have to go back really to 2001. And I think one of the general truths about Sudan's civil wars is that they begin and end with shifts of geopolitics. And they're transformed by shifts of geopolitics because in 2001, neither side has the capacity to militarily win. The Sudanese army, SAF, has control of most of the cities in the south, but they can't go outside the cities. They're in battled stockade towns. And surrounding it is the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, which is the force that then took over in South Sudan. This was largely, I mean, there were operations, but it was largely a detente. It was a stalemate. In 2001, something happens in America, as we know, and the war on terror begins. And there's been, prior to that, this 10-year campaign in America by evangelicals and senators, which is the sort of motley assortment of end-of-history liberals who believe that we should never have, you know, Rwanda again, combined with Christian evangelicists who think that the evil Muslim North is waging a war against the Christian South and we have to intervene. And they spent 10 years sort of trying to pressure the US government, but it was really 9/11 that transformed the US's perspective on what was happening, because suddenly, of course, Saddam was the country that had harbored Osama bin Laden during the 1990s.
Right.
And so suddenly there was this huge pressure on Sudan, and George W. Bush came in and really pushed them, along with Norway and Britain, to the negotiating table. And that led to an agreement in 2005. And Bashir's, the way that politics in terms of agreements is done in Sudan and in South Sudan now, is that you make an agreement and all the really difficult issues are just kicked down the table. Like agreements are sort of part of the process. There's been many, many agreements in both countries that are just, they're not sort of cessations of war. They're themselves a form of war. They're a type of negotiation. So in 2005, Bashir signed this agreement under massive pressure from the international community. Basically, I think with the hope that A, South Sudan wouldn't vote to secede, B, we'd never even get there. Because they would use military forces. So they've used, like, Bashir's playbook has always been, I mean, and this is inherited from Sadiq al-Mahdi before and other people who've run Sudan, to use militia forces to fight wars in the periphery of the country. It's a country with an incredibly dominant metropole, right? This riparian elite that I write about in the piece. The rest of the country is fundamentally, since the 1970s and the collapse of the economy under the debt crisis and the various oil crises of that period, has been like just a ground for labor and for resources to be used by the center. And they've policed it, really using the old meaning of police, with militias. So during the war, the people really fighting in the south was not so much the Sudan Armed Forces, but these militias from one of the South Sudanese groups called the Nuer, which took control of the oil fields and depopulated them, occasionally with the assistance of Swedish oil companies, so they could take control of the oil. So the hope, I think, for Bashir was they would use these same forces and we would never get to a referendum. But the problem is that Kiir, who then was who became the leader of South Sudan, was getting a huge amount of oil money from the oil, and so basically outpriced Bashir. And so bought off in this agreement called the, so when 2005, when the peace agreement signed, most of South Sudan is, well, not most, let's say a third of South Sudan is under the control of this force under Pelina Matiep, which is a militia force sponsored by Bashir, which is not included in the peace agreement at all. So there's this immediate crisis of like, what happens to a third of the country, which is also where all the oil is? And what Salva does is basically buys them off and integrates them into the army. Right. And that lays the groundwork for the civil war in South Sudan in 2013, right, which basically breaks open that unification. But it also means that Bashir has nothing, no way of buying out those militias and causing the disturbances that he needs to prevent the referendum. Given America's interest, right, this is like their belated Wilsonian moment. You know, like there was, like Erez Manella writes, right, about this moment where they could have actually backed self-determination and they chose not to. Well, here was like a belated self-determination.
Right.
America like considered itself, you know, the father. It was incredibly paternalistic to listen to the diplomats in that period. The father of this country, they were going to make it happen. And so Bashir basically knew that it was going to happen, was unless he was going to cause a sort of international incident that would block his relationship with America, he couldn't prevent it. So what he tried to do instead was diversify the Sudanese economy.
In the north?
In the north, in, right.
Right, okay, yeah.
And so the two things he did several things, but one of the things he did was try to reorientate Sudan's foreign policy away from Iran and Qatar towards the Emirates and Saudi. So Bahrain bought a piece of land the size of Bahrain. There were various like moments of agricultural security with Saudi Arabia coming in to buy land. But the other thing he did, which is more consequential for Sudan's politics, is that massive amounts of gold were discovered, largely in Darfur.
Right.
And then we have a double problem for Bashir. One is that not only has there been a war in the south, but since 2003, there's been a war in Darfur, fought by largely non-Arab groups against Arab forces that, again, Bashir instrumentalizes and turns into militias.
Right.
Now, the problem with gold rather than oil, especially like low-scale gold mining, is it requires a great deal of control of territory. And the person who is anointed to control that territory and basically, again, do a police operation, displacing rebels, defeating them, controlling the gold mines, is Hemeti.
For listeners here, Hemeti is the leader of the RSF.
Rapid Support Forces.
Yeah, which is the I don't know, which is one of the two main battle groups right now that are fighting.
Yes.
And sort of the deputy leader of the military dictatorship that took over in the coup last year. So that's Hemeti. And so Hemeti also controls the gold. I mean, there was a lot of gold discovered in Darfur. I think I was reading something by Adam Tooze recently where he talked about the whole Sahel has been kind of transformed in the last 10 years by all these gold discoveries. But the main deposits really are in Darfur, is that right?
Yes, Adam went to town on, as he does in his way, on gold mining. Hemeti began, as is now canonical law, as a camel trader. And his camels were taken. This is sort of like, I don't know how actually true this story is. It's too neat to be true.
But it's a great story, right?
7,000 camels were taken by the rebels, and thus, like, without, you know, his possibility of economic reproduction, he installs himself as an emir, as a war leader for his very small, it's an Arab Darfuri group that live both in Chad and Darfur. He has various links to, family links to people within the Chadian administration. He then becomes part of what was known as the Janjaweed, so literally evil horsemen. Right. And they were the Arab militias used by Bashir to fight the rebellion in 2003 and led to an endless series of war crimes and sexual abuse and the burning and killing of civilians. Many of the Janjaweed, by the time the RSF is created, have turned against Bashir. But Hemeti once rebelled against Bashir, and basically use that as in classic Sudanese form to leverage his potential rebellion to gain a better position in government. And so when these groups in the Janjaweed start turning against Bashir, Hemeti remains loyal. And so Hemeti becomes and is anointed the head of this new unit called the RSF. And there's been like one of the things that Bashir used to rule is that he would constantly make new security forces. And he would effectively coup-proof his regime by having them set against each other. So the army competes against the National Security Service, run for a long time by Salah Ghosh, a great CIA ally. Then there are the Popular Defense Forces. Then there's the Janjaweed of Musa Hilal. So there's all of these different forces. And Hemeti takes this moment and uses it. He creates a holding company, El Janed, his brother's running it, to basically introduce himself and go back, in a sense, to his roots as a trader by being a bazaar trader and expanding rapidly into real estate, construction, iron, fundamentally gold. And gold allows him to build a bridge to the Emirates.
Right.
Because almost the whole of Sudan's gold goes to Dubai.
Right.
Okay.
And then he's recruiting this army, the RSF, and he doesn't stop at Darfur. And this dip makes him different to many of the other militia leaders, which is he has not just, he has a national game, he has a Darfur game, and he has an international game. So one of the things he does via his Emirate connections is send troops to Yemen to fight on the Emirati mm-hmm. payroll,
right.
and to send troops to Libya to fight with Haftar.
Can you tell us a little about how those troops were used in Yemen and what you've heard about their service in Yemen?
There was a lot of losses. What, interestingly, the Saudis had also hired the army to fight in Yemen. And the commander of those forces happened to be a man named Burhan.
Oh, okay.
So you see already, right, way back, there's these two guys are sort of central to this basic, like, you know, externalization of the Sudanese war machine.
Right.
I mean, there were some pretty heavy losses by the RSF. Mm. And by 2019, there were complaints that it within Sudan that the RSF was growing too powerful and creating too much of an international scene. So after 2019, they pull back how many RSF are in Yemen.
Mm. Okay, yeah. That's amazing that the two leaders of these factions were rival mercenary sort of condottieri in Yemen at the same time.
Right.
In fact, there's that pairing up of, as you say, a basic Sudanese strategy so that, as you mentioned, Bashir would have expected South Sudan to be manageable because he can play the Dinka off the Nuer, but then the Dinka leader gets enough money that he can buy the Nuer, at least for the moment.
Right. I mean, I think this is, in a sense, what we're seeing now is the culmination of Bashir's form of rule, which is that he's always instrumentalized the peripheries to fight against each other. And so there's always been this sort of, if we want to be simple Marxists, like if the fundamental class antagonism of the country is between a center which is extractive of the resources of the periphery and the peripheries, what Bashir's genius was, and it built on the strategies of other Sudanese rulers, was to set actors in the periphery against each other.
Right.
And what we now have is the peripheral actor that he relied on, he called him Himiati, my protector, has come back to the center. And unlike all the other Sudanese civil wars we've ever had, this one is happening in Khartoum.
I noticed you retweeted a bit of Schadenfreude by a South Sudanese commentator who said, you know, with understandable bitterness, I suppose, we've been at war all this time and now they feel it in Khartoum.
You know. Absolutely.
So, first of all, your description of Hemeti, I mean, you know, leaving aside the obvious ruthlessness, the history of basically genocide and so on, I mean, he's also like an incredibly impressive in terms of being a genuine self-made person. I mean, he's not from the riparian elite, it sounds like, but is really quite self-made. So he must be, I don't know, more impressive in a sense than whoever his rivals are. Is that,
he's
like that?
He's incredibly smart, incredibly strategic. I think he's probably made some errors, like, you know, being photographed in Russia on the day the Ukrainian invasion starts wasn't a good move PR-wise. Right. Though he has his own, you know, it used to be a Canadian PR firm, now it's a French PR firm that's doing the RSF's social media, which is incredibly, is like sort of perfectly in the language of the UN.
I
as if
saw
they've
some
all
of that.
Gone
yeah.
to like human rights workshops. You know, but I think like the important thing there is like he is that, and I think that not only is he immensely disliked by the army elite as a challenge to their economic empire, and disliked by the central politicians who look down on him, But I think also a degree of that, let's call it what it is, like racism and classism really infiltrates into the international picture given of Hemeti. Right. So like every profile has to begin with he left school at second grade.
Right.
As if somehow that sort of disallows him. It was third grade. Sorry. Disallows him to be, you know, a smart and intelligent leader. And I think this also happens with the question of command and control. There's this claim that the RSF are not in command and control of their forces. One, as if SAF, the Sudanese army, is not meting out atrocities everywhere.
Right,
and is not in control. Right? And two, I think a lot of what RSF is doing is pretty structural and strategic, even when horrible and brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't buy the story that this is all, you know, like renegade RSF guys. No, it seems pretty rational and thought through in many respects. I mean, I think another way to see it is that the RSF in general, though they're now a multi-ethnic force from around the country, is run basically by his clan, by his family members, and has an amazing degree of command and control. SAF, on the other hand, the Sudan Armed Forces, has on the one hand Burhan, but there's also a whole comportment of it, which are Islamists, which are NCP members, so Bashir's party, the National Congress Party, within it. And in many ways, I think the army is much more fundamentally fragmented than Hemeti is.
Yeah, that was an interesting angle that Hemeti's people are now saying, and you can tell this was an obvious tactical PR move, though it may well be true also, that you know he had to step in because the army was trying to bring back those hardcore Islamists. I mean, something that will obviously play well in the West, and as I say, may also be true. So there's a lot of sophistication in the RSF messaging.
Yeah, it's certainly not entirely false. Like after the coup happens, is October 2021. The army found itself in a difficult situation because it doesn't really have a social base. It doesn't, and it doesn't have an ideology, which the NCP, which Bashir did, right? At least, you know, certainly for the first 10 years of his rule, he was ruling in lockstep with the Islamists. Mm-hmm. So then they're like, okay, how do we run this country? Under what conditions? And they immediately started to look for a civilian head of the government. Hamdok, who was the previous UN economist who was running the civilian part of the government, came back for 6 weeks and then immediately left again after street protests. So they were they needed some sort of civilian complement. And because they didn't find it, what they ended up doing was relying more and more on the Kezan, which is the sort of colloquial name for the old regime.
Okay.
That happens. Well, I think at this point, if you could give us a synopsis of how what led to the events of the last week, this outbreak of what seems to be turning into, almost like a civil war. It's certainly, you know, between the two major military forces. But if you could sort of explain how it came to be again for listeners, so they have a better grasp too of what Hemeti represents and what Al-Burhan represents. Yeah.
So this is going to be like an eagle's view in 2 minutes, and then maybe we can come back to sort of the interesting things. I think this fundamentally is the end game of Bashir's regime playing out.
Mm.
In that how Bashir ruled is by creating the security services, so the RSF, as we said, to run the gold in Darfur. From the very beginning, they were also used to repress protesters in Khartoum, and SAF, the Sudanese army, which had built up this huge economic empire under Bashir. What Bashir had done in the 1990s, continuing what Nimeiri had done before him, is effectively privatize the state. Mm. So they removed the provision of services. They gave, and by privatize, I mean, they gave aspects of the state functioning and businesses to selected private actors within the state infrastructure of these security organs. So it was a privatization to Bashir's friends. And he ruled above them and constantly tried to coup-proof his regime by building one up, building the other up, breaking them down.
So under the rubric of Islamism, of Bashir's Islamism, there was also this sort of substructure of like, I don't know, a kind of neoliberal privatization of the
absolutely.
State.
I mean, and that's the the if you like in boring Marxist terms, like the superstructure here is Islamism of a certain sort. The infrastructure is neoliberal privatization and the use of militias to rule and to implement the rule of the order, like the rule of the state, which is violence, in all the peripheries. So you know, in some sort of ways, you could do a much bigger, like sort of Quinn Sobaldian history of neoliberalism in the Horn, which said that the place that the police play in places like America are played by militias structurally. Not they're not doing the same things, but what they're doing is repressing by force of violence, and that's the system that breaks down in 2018, 2019. It breaks down because for a long time, Bashir has, as you said, not received money from South Sudan. There's been no oil coming in. There's not been insufficient oil money. They lost 75% of their income. And Bashir is casting around. He's trying to sell land. He's trying to get gold. But it's not enough money. And so he breaks the thing, which is fundamentally his pact with the urban cities of Sudan. So much of Sudan eats sorghum or millet, not wheat. The cities eat wheat. They eat bread. Mm. And what Bashir did was subsidize bread and fuel. Enormous subsidy to the middle classes, but also what kept things alive.
I seem to remember that there were riots about the price of cooking oil in Khartoum a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, there's this is, you know, these are protests created by a state which is always in perpetual survival mode and always trying to maintain this transactional machine where it's paying off commanders, bringing them in, and the system just started to seize up. And so what Bashir did was to stop subsidies on fuel and wheat, fundamentally, which in 2018 led to the protests. And the protests began in the periphery in Etamazin, in a place called Blue Nile, spread to the former sites of labor militancy, like Atbara. Atbara was the great site of the railway union, which was destroyed first by Nimeiri and then really by Bashir, again, acting like a good sort of Western neoliberal, getting rid of the unions in the 1990s, like Tony Blair. And then these protests spread all across the country, and they spread to Khartoum, and they increasingly became really powerful. And at this moment, there's the emergence that really they were sort of first formed in 2013 of resistance committees. So these non-hierarchical forms of local organization with a lot of socioeconomic demands behind them. And they're non-hierarchical partly to resist the incursion of the National Security Service of Bashir, which is all over the country and is also an economic empire and a military force. And this is the force that really brings down Bashir, because then the commanders around him, including Hemeti, realize that in order to save their own economic empires, to save the structure of the state, as it were, they need to get rid of the head of the state.
Yeah, he had drawn a lot of hatred by that time.
A lot of heat.
Been around a long time.
Yeah.
Right. So they hope that they get rid of Bashir, and then they can continue basically with, you know, the Security Council that Bashir had, Hemeti, Ibn Auf, these people, Kabashi, could continue in command, and everything would change and nothing would change. But no one was satisfied with that. So the general who deposed him with Hemeti's backing, Ibn Auf, lasts 24 hours, and the protests continue. And in fact, they intensify, and they lead to a sit-in in front of the military headquarters. And what we should say here, just for people who haven't been to Khartoum, is that as you're driving in from the airport, the city is entirely dominated by this enormous military headquarters. And everyone is there, right? Like, so there's the Air Force, and they have a building which is supposed to look like a carrier plane. The Navy, they're in a building that looks like an ark. So it's, you know, it's this sort of like magic winter wonderland of military dominance.
Military world, kids.
Right? And all the kids are outside and they're like, we're going to shut you down. And the army sort of plays for time for a while, which is a classic thing that you do in Sudanese politics, and until they get really scared and they shut down the sit-in. And this was occurred on June 3rd, 2019. And there's continual disagreement about who led this, but certainly Hemeti was involved and the RSF were involved. It led to hundreds of deaths, hundreds of wounded, and again, didn't break the street.
Right.
The street protests continued. There was a million-man march on June 30th, which was the anniversary of Bashir taking power in a coup in 1989. And then there was a real division between the civilian political opposition in Sudan and the street. And I think a lot of the people on the street wanted to have protests leading to a general strike. There was a small general strike, and then there was a plan for a bigger general strike, really to insist on the military being entirely pushed out of power.
Right.
And in the meantime, the civilian politicians are kind of worried about the street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, they're not per se representative. I mean, inside this coalition called the FFC, the Freedom of Forces and Change, the Forces of Freedom and Change, which is the coalition that ends up joining the military and the transitional government, you have the Baathists, you have the Nasserists, you have these weird relics of politics that sort of congealed at the last moment there was actually democracy.
Right.
But they're not necessarily representative, but they're kind of worried about the street. And they think this is an ideal moment.
I would guess they'd be used to dealing with the military, but the street is a new force, and who knows if you can talk to them.
And who is the street? I mean, is it really totally spontaneous and leaderless, or are there, you know, I'm sure they're trying to manipulate the street and they clearly failed, but who was the street? Who were the people who were out there? Was it every class?
So the street, again, wants a bunch of different things. And that question, who is the street, was the question that every diplomat has been asking me, you know, for years. What is protest? Who are street protesters?
Yeah.
Where is their leader? Can we negotiate with them? Why don't they form an organization?
Right.
Yeah. And I think the answer is it really varies, right? Because as protests, went all around Khartoum, you would have resistance committees in neighborhoods like Kalakla, which is a very, working class, informal class, groups of radicals who have received nothing from the Bashir regime, to places like Buri, which has long been a center of middle-class radicalism, and before that, working-class radicalism, and also the nicest districts of Khartoum, whose resistance committees looked and sounded a lot like NGOs. So there wasn't I don't think you can give a unified picture, but they genuinely were drawn from all the different classes, and they were also existing in the peripheries. And I think if you were going to typify what they wanted, and there's been a number of sort of unified resistance committees declarations, both then and subsequently, the emphasis is really on a transformed socioeconomic picture of what Sudan is.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So not just a change in the form of government in the center, but a change in the center-periphery relationship. Questions of, for instance, in Darfur, the question of justice and reparations, of finding some sort of closure to the horrors of those wars.
Right.
In places like Blue Nile, it was also about autonomy and self-governance from the center.
Something that strikes me about all these stories is the overwhelming predominance of Khartoum, as if it were the city. But occasionally you'll hear something about other cities along the Nile, like Meroe. So is Khartoum that overwhelmingly dominant?
In the politics, yeah. It's like 17th century France. I mean, it's in Paris, right? It's
Paris and the provinces.
Yes, it is the center of the political class. And then it has its satellite cities, Omdurman, its sister city across the river. But it really is the place where politics is done, and the periphery often feels, I think, and has felt and does feel very far away. You know, what happened in June 2019, July, August, is that if you were to be uncharitable, the FFC, this coalition of political parties and trade unions, sold the movement down the river. There was this crucial moment where they could have tried to push the military out. I think if you were going to be sympathetic to the FFC, then they were worried about either a civil war or a bloodbath.
Mm-hmm.
If you were going to be cynical about them, you'd say they were actually threatened by the street protests and wanted to conserve power. And so what you got was this transitional government in 2019 that was, from the beginning, a mess. It was a mess in many different ways. So it had a Supreme Council led by Burhan, with Hemeti, and so Burhan is the head of the Sudanese army, and his deputy was Hemeti, who then goes out and tries to be the sort of the real statesman in the room, as opposed to the army commander. And then it has a civilian government that the FFC has appointed, led by this man Hamdok, this UN-trained economist, whose first finance minister is taken directly from international financial institutions, right? Mm. He's an alum of the IMF. Right. And they sort of give a first speech and they say the central economic question for Sudan is the payment of its debt.
God. Right.
And the first things that they end up doing really are like they almost like work for international consumption.
Yeah.
So they're, you know,
they don't
like,
know anything listening differently if they're from that background. It's
right,
like
right.
So it's they, just the same like, Washington consensus shit. Yeah.
Right. But Badawi yeah. fails, but a later finance minister ends up lifting the sanctions. And in some ways you can see them, this is slightly uncharitable, but as an intensification of Bashir's regime.
Mm.
Right. So in just before the coup, I would talk to members of the resistance committees who go, look, it used to be the case that there was a military machine and neoliberal policies of austerity. And they were united in Bashir's government. Now there is a military machine and there's a civilian government doing the politics of austerity, and they right. appear to be opposed. And the international community treats it like this is the opposition, but this is a false opposition because right. they're both actually carrying out different aspects of what Bashir was trying to do.
Yeah. You cited an article by Khaled Khair, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing her name, but about the deep error that the NGOs and the foreign advisors made in assuming that there would have to be a military government of some kind, that Sudan wasn't ready, whatever that means, to transition to civilian rule.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the beginning, from the fall of Bashir, the international community has been very suspicious of the street. It's non-hierarchical. Its economic agenda does not conform to the diktats of the IMF and the World Bank. And they were very proud of their realism. And realism dictated that we needed to have an accommodation with the military that would lead to civilian rule. And I think from the beginning, the Americans, the UN, have been focused on framework agreements, implementation agreements. And they've been largely uninterested, to be honest, in the real business of politics.
Mm.
So, you know, Hamdok's government sort of sells its legitimacy down the river. And for a moment, he is the most popular politician probably in Sudan's history.
Wow.
You know, when he takes power, right? But he doesn't use it to build up. He doesn't take up that force of the revolution and use it to pressure the army. It kind of dissolves. And it dissolves also because international money doesn't come quick enough. So the U.S. hang its aid on Sudan normalizing ties with Israel, which happens later and like is not popular among the FFC.
Yeah.
The initial attempt to liberalize the economy is blocked by members of the FFC because they know they're going to lose popular support. It only happens later. So that and all of the actual questions, the real questions, which are about is the army, including Hemeti, running the economy, are blocked. So there's a dismantling committee. The dismantling committee is there to destroy what remains of the NCP, the old economic empire of Bashir. And the army looks at this and Hemeti looks at them and goes, no, we don't want to do that. We want to take it over.
Yeah.
We don't want to block it. So they want to dismantle the dismantling committee.
In your article, Gunshots in Khartoum, in New Left Review, you have an amazing account of the way the economy was divided between the various forces like the Sudanese army, the National Intelligence and Security Service, and the RSF. The military runs the construction firms, the mining services, the banks, and the RSF takes over gold mining and, as you say, lucrative mercenary services.
Right. Because I think fundamentally the other problem here is that it's fundamentally an extractive industry.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's an economy based on what like Bayard would call extroversion. So you get the resources from the periphery, but you don't rely on political legitimacy from those communities.
Right.
You rely on the foreign currency that those resources are bringing in. And in a sense, the condition of bringing in that foreign currency is the suppression of the communities from which the resources come from.
Yeah. It's like imperialism, but within a state kind of thing.
Yes, so, exactly. Yeah, and I think that's like it's not an accident that this is the inheritance of a British colonial model.
Of course.
Right. And the British were probably much worse at it and much more amateurish. But there is that sense that the one of the sort of the weirdnesses, I think, about this current war, which I will get to where it begins, is that we have two forces fighting all over the country, neither of which have very much popular legitimacy.
I wanted to ask you that I've heard, I don't really understand the current control maps about Sudan, and I'm not sure there is that kind of control, but they do show the RSF controlling Darfur and controlling parts of the south as well. First of all, is that accurate? And if it's accurate, is it because they just have the preponderance of forces or because they have real support?
So there's definitely support for the RSF within the Darfur Arab groups. But even there, it's complicated because Hemeti came to power by pushing out Musa Hilal, who was the former great Janjaweed leader. Musa Hilal has been backed by the army to be a counterweight in Darfur. And let's not forget that Hemeti waged a war against all the Darfuri rebel groups for a decade, killing thousands of people. So he's not a popular figure in Darfur.
Right.
In some areas, right? And it's so command and control is uncertain. There are many different stories. I would say that in general, the story that I'm hearing in the media is almost exactly wrong. It's almost like the inverted image of what's the actuality on the ground. So like there's a claim that that the Sudan Armed Forces is running Khartoum or is about to win back Khartoum. The reverse is true. Like street by street, it's the RSF who are making gains. They made gains in the south of Khartoum yesterday. They just took over the major munitions factory in the northwest to the northwest of Khartoum today. And the reason for that partly is that they have experience fighting in cities from Libya, from Yemen. And they're much, I mean, it's a smaller force, right? It's probably half the size, two-thirds of the size of the army. But they have the experience. And SAF don't. In fact, much of the fighting for SAF, as far as I understand it, in Khartoum, is being done by what used to be the National Security Services Operations Brigade.
Okay.
So these are much closer to the Islamists. And so Khartoum is run by RSF. And it will continue to be run largely, I think, by the RSF. The planes can't do that much. They can bomb the barracks, which has been great and cinematic. But there's no one in the barracks.
Yeah, it struck me as kind of a bad sign for the army that they're already using the air force in Khartoum so heavily. Because one thing you learn in 21st century war is that you can't just, unless you're going to bomb the city out of existence, which has been done a few times, you can't just do it with air power. You have to go in and clear out the buildings. And if you can't do that, if you can't make your soldiers do that, it's a bad sign when you have your air forces. But I wanted to ask, when you were sitting in these cafes or whatever, like in normal daily life in the days before this war broke out, was the RSF a presence? Was the SAF a presence?
The RSF was definitely a presence. The RSF was invited basically to keep control of Khartoum in April 2019 by Bashir. So he sort of let, you know, from the SAF's perspective, let the beast into the house. They were definitely on the street. It wasn't like, you know, in comparison, like Juba, the capital of South Sudan, after 6 p.m. there are checkpoints throughout the city and the army is a massive, and the National Security Service and so on, are a massive presence. It wasn't like that in Sudan. Like, you know, I'd get tailed by national security, but there wasn't this sort of like overarching serious military presence, except, you know, in protests in the week running up to the coup and in army checkpoints around the military headquarters. But it wasn't the sort of, you know, if you've been in like Baghdad when America was there, it wasn't that militarization of the city. That was sort of lying latently because the RSF had installed themselves in residential areas.
Right. Were they distinctive? I mean, did they stand out as Darfuri people or provincials as opposed to the urbanites?
You know, Sudan is a massively multi-ethnic country, and we should say. And one of the things that Hemeti did was try to broaden the RSF's base, if not its command, And he did that pretty successfully, partly by offering people the opportunities to fight in Yemen. And the money you'd get for fighting in Yemen is three or four times what you'd get working for the RSF in Sudan. So that's why, just to come back on your earlier questions, there is RSF support, especially among the Misriya, which is a group in South Kordofan. And the RSF recently have won a series of battles against SAF, including El Obeid in Kordofan, which is one of the, like, between North and South Kordofan, one of the largest areas inside. So they're not just Darfuri. They are, of course, also Darfuri. I think you see this racism, which unfortunately is mirrored by the international media, with everyone going, ah, look, they speak French. Ah, they are from Chad. Ah, they have two nationalities. But of course, you know, Darfur and Chad has always had so much movement between them. I mean, not just refugees, but like groups that shared like populations on both sides of the border. And the idea that that makes somehow marks them as impure is itself, I think, a sort of a legacy of a racism of the center.
Yeah.
And yes, like you can, it's much more easy to work out who's RSF because they wear lighter color uniforms. And their mode of fighting is different, right? Like the RSF, you know, like forged itself as Janjaweeds in the Darfuri Wars. So everyone's mounted on technicals, so on Toyotas, with 12.4mm machine guns in the back. And they drive very fast and they shoot a lot of bullets. How many of them are accurate? Nah. Right? And so it's a very different like logic of war to the way SAF fight. Or to the way, you know, there's no artillery here. There isn't like infantry in the same fashion. And you know, the RSF were very good at doing what they were doing.
Right.
But so there's not, it's not, they do have support in some of the country. And then it's a patchwork. They don't have much support. They're certainly not a popular national force. He's not a popular politician in that way. He, just as much as the army, is a sort of legacy of Bashir's transactional politics and this military extractive machine. And I think the sort of the weirdness about that is that if this war ends, in a way, everything will have to start again in terms of the actual like discussion over the shape of the country.
Right.
Yeah.
Because what we did have was that, you know, since 2019, the fall of Bashir, the entire international community's question has been civilians or military? Civilians or military? How do they live together? Now everyone's forgotten about the civilians. It's just military versus military. But that's never going to answer the question of how to rule Sudan.
Yeah. Well, and the U.S. and the kind of NGO world probably is also like, just have elections and that solves everything, right? Which, you know, maybe it could, and it would certainly be nice, but like it also could not, if you're not really talking about the deep structural problems there. And also, I imagine the more it gets fractured, the more even elections could be really fraught.
The international community really briefly did two, I think, really problematic things. One is that after we had this transitional government, after Bashir falls, there's still a war going on in Sudan between the peripheries and the center. And Hemeti and the army take the lead in a negotiation called the Juba Agreement, Juba Peace Agreement, which brings the rebels into government. And so what was once a civilian transitional government is now full of rebel leaders. And it uses those rebel leaders to split the civilians and prepare the ground for the coup.
Right.
But for the internationals, this is great because it means war's finished and they can put a poster, you know, on their desk at state in Foggy Bottom saying, look, we've helped end the war. Yep. That was the first problem. And then more importantly, the coup's failing September, October last year. So, and the internationals don't want the coup to happen anymore. They need to spend their donor money and so on and so forth. So they push the forces into the framework agreement. Framework agreement is signed last December, and it's an agreement between Hemeti, Burhan. It recognizes Hemeti and the existence of the RSF, which has always been contested, and several of the civilian partners and the FFC. What this does is introduce a new dynamic in Sudanese politics where it's no longer the army against the civilians, but it becomes both of the two main armed forces of Burhan and Hemeti trying to recruit to them civilian political support, rebel support from the peripheries, and external support.
Right.
And so really the framework agreement sets in motion the war that we now have, right? Like it's a war produced by partly bad international politics. Maybe it would have happened anyway, but like at least like the precipitating factor. And as part of this, the internationals announced that we would like a government by the end of Ramadan. They have to now resolve security sector reform. And security sector reform, as Khulod often says, is the process. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. It is the question of the future of the militarized economy of the country. And this would take a year, 2 years, if there was political will from the two parties. And instead they have a month.
Right.
But you mentioned one thing that struck me about this, and it seems a cold-hearted thing to say, but most urban fighting is very brutal and features a lot of atrocities against civilians. But if there's one thing that's been maybe just biased news coverage, but my impression is there haven't been a lot of massacres of civilians by either side so far. And often there is, if one side decides civilians in X neighborhood belong to the other side, they're going to be in great danger. But I haven't heard much about that. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. But has it happened?
Not really. There's been some attacks on markets, for instance, especially in Darfur. Thus far, it really is two sort of extraneous military machines fighting for the fate of a country in which no one really recognizes themselves in either of these things. And if they do, it's because opportunistically they needed to get a job. And one of the ways, if you're a young man, to survive and to provide for a family is to become a young foot soldier for one of these forces. That could change, right? I think like one of the dangers is that there are, of course, like deep ethnic dimensions to this. There's the racism of the center against the periphery. There are the Arab populations in Darfur who look worried and look to Hemeti in part, right? And then at the same time, the rebels from Darfur, so Mini Menawi, Jibril, Ibrahim, have joined with Burhan. Having been with Hemeti, their former foe, they've switched loyalty during something called the Cairo process. Doesn't really matter what it was. And so you have the ground there for really, for sort of the two forces to take hold of extant ethnicized fractures in the country. And that would be the horrific development that would really lead to a generalized civil war.
Right.
Right.
That's awful. Could we talk about the international aspect of it too? Because, you know, obviously the first way to understand this, and it was, again, so helpful about your article, is you get an understanding of this new war from the inside, from the sort of domestic, you know, political, economic, cultural, you know, background. But a lot of the Western press, at least, is a lot more focused on the international players in this, and kind of particularly they want to talk about Russia, right? I mean, obviously Russia is first on the minds of as like villain number one, but their role in this seems not as clear cut. It doesn't seem as clear cut in a way, except that they're certainly not a force for democracy and good, you know, the Wagner group and whatever. But everybody seems to have some interest there, and they find themselves, I don't know, on side. So it seems that, you know, Wagner group is with Hemeti, but the Russian state maybe is with Al-Burhan, which would be kind of weird that the Russian state would be on difference, if that's even true, from Wagner, that the UAE is with Hemeti, that this Sisi and the Egyptians are with Barani and the army. What could you say about it? Oh, and the U.S. again, the U.S. is like, it's Israel is their first priority in this. And the second one is sort of, let's get a deal done by this date and get an elections that we can sort of sell to the people. But anyway, what's your impression of the role that they're playing and in the lead up to this, I guess, and then like going forward, what role they might be playing?
I mean, I think the first important thing to be saying is that this is not a war as of yet dominated by external parties.
Right.
And if you want to look for its structure and its agency, you have to look to the Sudanese actors.
Yes.
So Saudi and the Emirates have played both sides. They've been not particularly reliable backers of either. So they signed off on the coup in October 2021 and promised financial assistance, which they then failed to deliver to the coup participants, which was part of why the regime was weak. The Emirates have always been pretty close to to Hemeti, and partly because all the gold goes via Hemeti, but it's only particular princes who are close to Hemeti, whereas other princes are much closer to Burhan, and so they have also played the double game in that way. Hemeti's closest ally is Mansur bin Zayed Al Nahyan, the owner, as you know, of Manchester City.
Right.
Soccer club.
I saw that.
You know, and whereas Tahnun has gone in with Burhan. So I don't think there's much of a coherence. I think there's a lot of opportunism. And there's been reports from the Americans and from others that via Haftar, the Emiratis have sent money and ammo and materiel to Hemeti, which I don't have external sources to confirm, but seems entirely believable. The Russians, again, are playing a double game, but they're also not that active. And so we should say not only are they playing a double game, but of course all the parties involved are playing a double game. So Burhan was cultivating the Russians. Back in September, Burhan was also sending guns to Ukraine.
Ah, interesting.
And I interviewed some of the people on those flights. No one's ever picked up on this story. So I'm just, you know.
Interesting.
So he was at the same time, like, you know, cultivating Putin and sending guns to Ukraine. And on the other hand,
there's a lot
like
of
Hemeti,
that, I have to say, you know.
Right. I mean, I think this is the really, like, the interesting aspect of this, you know, new multipolar world, which is there's like this scalar logic of alliances where people can be opposed in, you know, like people can be opposed in Libya and on the same side in in Sudan and vice versa, right? Like it's almost as if there is no, the enemy of my enemy is not my friend. It's like in different situations, I will hate you and I will love you depending on what's happening, right? But there's no sort of coherence to this picture. There's, I mean, I think the great fear for Burhan is that Ethiopia will take advantage or intervene. And there has been contact between Hemeti and Ethiopia. But Ethiopia is also massively divided.
Yes.
Yeah, we've had people wondering if the collapse of Sudan, if it happens, will destroy the whole region. Or, I mean, there seems to be an argument between no, the collapse of Sudan will destroy the whole region, and no, the collapse of Ethiopia would destroy the whole region. But clearly, these two Nile powers are very important. And between them, South Sudan, I assume, is still too weak and too divided to do much. Is that correct?
The South Sudanese government itself is divided because Tukulgat Luwak, who's the sort of main security advisor to the president, who is Bashir's adopted son, is very close to Hemeti. And several people close to South Sudan's president are very close to Hemeti, and they're currently trying to sort of get themselves out of those connections because Salva, like the president's main alliance, is with Burhan. But there's not going to be a sort of a decisive military intervention from South Sudan or a decisive diplomatic intervention. So that's the, I mean, everyone is sort of looking for backers. That there have been claims that the Wagner Group has offered Hemeti service to air missiles, but I don't have external confirmation of that beyond what I read in the press. So there's, you know, I think there's more rumors than anything else. The one thing we can say for certain is that Egypt is decisively in with Burhan and will not accept Hemeti as a figure, and have been providing fighter pilots and have been providing fighter jets, and that that is clear, and I have proof of that.
And why is that? Why is Sisi so?
Because Sisi like sees in Burhan and sees in the military like its little brother. And to be sure, the Sudanese army was always modeled on the Egyptian army, right? And if you look at the Egyptian army's economic empire, well, look, that's what Sudan's doing. And let's not forget that it was the previous colonial regime was the Anglo-Egyptian condominium government. It was Egypt as well. So there's this long history in which Hemeti is this, you know, dangerous militia figure from the provinces. And so that's, it's so, he's so disliked by the Egyptians that they're willing to go in with Burhan, though Burhan has links to the old regime. And the problem between Egypt and Sudan previously, or one of the many problems, was the Islamists.
Right.
right? Because, of course, Sisi is no friend of the Ikhwan, of the Brotherhood.
Of course, yeah.
So at the moment, they're sort of holding their nose and backing Burhan with the idea that he can control the various sort of forces that he's summoning up.
Man, this is so wild, whole story, you know, and just complex. And it doesn't seem like it's going to end anytime soon. It doesn't seem like it's something very easy to patch up, because even if you patch it up, it's going to keep falling apart. And I guess if one side completely subjugates the other, but it seems that both sides are, one has kind of numerical superiority and superiority in certain weapons, but the other has kind of mobility and training superiority. It doesn't seem like it's going to end anytime
soon. No, it's going to be urban fighting, and you can easily reach a stalemate in urban fighting. Just fire across a street at each other for months and months.
What are you hearing on the future of this war, like and bottling it up or something?
I think for Hemeti, it's an existential war.
Right.
This is his one shot. No one, you know, like the elite don't like him. He's the unpopular kid in high school. And here is the capacity to take power. What he tried to do after the framework agreement was really reach out to the civilians, to the FFC, and position himself as the person that could take South Sudan into a civilian transition. A ceasefire comes with a return of the basic issue, right? Which is that what led to this war was an SSR, a security sector reform discussion that had the RSF being integrated into the army. If they're integrated into the army, his control of gold, his control of his troops goes. Right. There's no future for him there unless he can be given massive amounts of assurances. So I think for Hemeti, there is no chance of him turning back from this.
Yes.
Because I don't think he ever gets another chance to run Sudan.
Right.
And if the situation becomes one in which he's really losing, then what you get is you get another war in Darfur, which has never actually stopped, right? In which he becomes one of the forces against the government in Darfur. I think Burhan has more possibilities of sort of coming to the table, like just like strategically in terms of like he's representing an institution. He's actually, so, but I'd say two things. One is we shouldn't underestimate the depth of hatred felt by many in the elite and in the middle ranks of the army against Hemeti. Hatred which is both racist, based on him being an upstart, based on the RSF's, but you know, that's one.
Yes.
Two, we shouldn't underestimate the hatred of Hemeti by the old regime, because Hemeti sold out Bashir.
Right.
And I think another possibility that will come if this war continues is that Burhan is deposed from within the army, and that Burhan is replaced by a figure much closer to the old regime.
Right. And more brutal in a sense.
Yeah, Burhan, I know this is superficial, but when you look at these figures in little video clips, Burhan doesn't seem that strong. He doesn't seem that tough. Hemeti does look pretty tough.
Yeah.
But presumably, just because of the nature of the army, there are people behind Burhan, either to step into his shoes or to support him if he's doing what they want. I don't know. Are there people behind Hemeti, or is his base shallow?
I mean, I think that's the difference. If you killed Burhan or deposed Burhan, then Kobashi or a variety of other generals could take over. If Hemeti dies, well, the RSF have really...
Yeah.
His second in command is his brother.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. Well, yeah. Presumably people have thought of that. So I hope he travels with a...
if you wanted just to end the conflict today without questions about justice or adequacy or whatever, but just like stop the fighting, then you would work out where Hemeti is and you'd just kill him.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I think that it would be seismic, the effect on the RSF, and it might create a totally unpredictable period of violence.
Yeah.
Because the RSF know that even if there's an amnesty for them, that they're going to be in for it. But that's he's not substitutable in the way that Burhan is substitutable.
Right.
Right.
I really appreciate it, Joshua, coming on and giving us this. I mean, this is more than an overview. This gives you a real deeper, nuanced sense. And it's depressing, as most wars are. It's pretty depressing.
But, you know, to sound cold-hearted, it makes a wonderful, intricate narrative sense.
It does,
There's none of this senselessness that is attributed to every place outside D.C. and London by the mainstream press.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense
in its
own terms.
Yeah. It's not ideological, though, but in every other way it makes perfect sense, yeah. And it's intricate, I mean, in its own intricate way, yeah. Really appreciate you taking the time. That was great. Thanks for joining us. That's Joshua Craze. We're going to post links to his articles, to Gunshots in Khartoum in the New Left Review, and to your personal webpage as well. And I think you had a mention of you have a book you're working on, right, about South Sudan.
Well, it's about the relationship of war to bureaucracy to silence.
Right.
It's for Fitzgerald Editions in London, but it's a literary book that sort of takes you through 10 years of trying to talk sense to the State Department.
And other
things, among other matters.
So
it's a sort of like, what does it mean to be an expert and a war writer today in the 21st century? And what relationship does knowledge have to politics? But mainly it's jokes about U.S. officials. So, you know, that's my main selling point.
That's
for
great.
It.
Yeah. That sounds like a great book.
A rich field.
Yes. We'll have to have you on when that comes out.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks again, Joshua Craze, and we'll be back after a quick break. Okay, that was our discussion with Joshua Craze about the violence in Sudan, which threatens to potentially turn into something like a civil war, even though no one seems to really care about taking a particular side at this moment. Mm-hmm. But he does sort of explain how this could transform pretty easily, and also how it could end, which, I mean, I don't know, it could end. Hemeti's side seems like the weaker side if you were an outside power betting, if only because it's so top-heavy. Without Hemeti, the whole RSF project seems to die. On the other hand, it's probably got a better fighting force than the SAF. So
it seems like it's winning on the ground in Khartoum. But at the same time, there's a reason that the Confederates always yell, "General Lee to the rear," because if he gets shot in the head, it's all over a lot sooner. And that's what happens if Hemeti dies.
Yeah, I didn't ask Joshua in our interview, but it does kind of hit me. Like, it seems there is a real possibility, let's say if Hemeti's forces really gain the upper hand, of a more serious intervention by Egypt and El-Sisi. I mean, put it this way, I wouldn't be totally surprised. You know, when you do read the history of Sudan, and Joshua alluded to this, I mean, that condominium, first the Egyptian Ottoman forces, and then I guess the Egyptian British. I mean, the Egyptians kind of see Sudan as their backyard, and Sisi probably more so than even others, and probably will. I wouldn't be surprised if they intervene more overtly.
Yeah. There are all kinds of ways of intervening.
I mean,
assassination to me is the one that comes to mind. Egypt has a lot more money than Sudan, and presumably there's somebody in his entourage who would be interested in making a phone call for $20 million. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyways, thank you again to Joshua Kreis for coming on the show. And thanks, John, Brendan, and everyone. Yeah,
thanks, everybody.
Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.